This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault Director Polly Poskin says use of non-disclosure agreements in workplace harassment cases serves as a cover-up.
Something needs to limit, you know, if not eradicate, these confidentiality agreements. They really serve to protect the defendant.
GLT's Mary Cullen reports on silencing victims through non-disclosure agreements. Plus, a new look on globalization of the entertainment industry from ISU political scientist Lane Crothers. And the mayor of Normal stops by to talk about a multi-sport complex. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A $43.6 million indoor-outdoor sports complex would make Bloomington Normal an even bigger sports tourism destination and have a multi-generational impact on public health. That's the message delivered last night by a consultant that Bloomington Normal leaders hired to study the project viability. GLT's Ryan Denham was at last night's joint meeting and has this report.
The consultant, Sports Facilities Advisory, or SFA, recommended a massive complex in a location still to be determined. It should have 16 outdoor fields, including 12 with lights and synthetic turf. Evan Ela from Sports Facilities Advisory says it should also have a dome.
It's 130,000 square feet. That's because it's really effective to build at that size. That gives you an oversized field. It can be cross-lined with five multi-purpose fields. And then another key difference maker for you, you can run two full youth baseball or softball fields at 225 feet in this facility. So we looked for the most dynamic, most flexible, most usable, most useful facility for you.
He says that combination of fields and amenities would be enough to attract both regional youth sports tournaments and serve local needs.
You have to invest in the size and the quality of this facility in order to compete. What's happening right now in sports tourism is that a lot of communities already have and are planning to invest. If you go up to Rockford, if you look anywhere in Chicago, if you look at Indianapolis and all sorts of others, there's major investment into this. You can't expect to put a parking lot in with some grass fields and just stripe them for a tournament and expect to compete in the long term. That's not going to be an option.
Bloomington and Normal split the cost of the consultant's $47,000 study, along with the Bloomington Normal Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. All three met for a joint session Monday night at Heartland Community College. It was their first look at the results of SFA's research. SFA estimates the complex would have a $9.5 million direct annual economic impact by year five, hosting between 8 and 15 tournaments that draw regional visitors. Elef says that Bloomington Normal already has enough hotels and restaurants to support an influx of out-of-town visitors.
This market can support people coming in. You've got some capacity throughout the year. You've got certainly a lot of properties and a lot of options, a lot of different price points. We see that as a real benefit that a lot of markets that are sort of this size and also that are a little bit isolated from major population bases, a lot of them simply don't have that, and they'd have to wait for hotels to come in and restaurants to come in to support tournaments and events. You've got a pretty good starting point here.
He says the complex would also meet local needs, such as a new home for the Illinois Fire Junior soccer program, which will soon lose its community fields near Central Illinois Regional Airport. And the complex's outdoor side would include a full-size cricket field, a rarity in this area.
And one of the things that we found through our data collection and through our interviews was that you have a pretty significant cricket population here, primarily going up to Chicago on a regular basis. We'd like to bring some of those Chicago people down here with this asset. And so cricket, we think, is unique to you. We don't recommend cricket in many communities, but we do think it's a big opportunity here.
Elected officials asked several questions after the presentation. Here's Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner.
Is there a likelihood that we will cannibalize each other as more and more communities begin to have to be destinations, and how do we control for that?
Here's Bloomington Alderman Karen Schmidt.
Could you talk a little bit about your calculations that would make this accessible to everybody in our community, regardless of their income levels?
Normal Town Council member Kathleen Lorenz.
At this point, what would be a path for dialogue with the community?
And Alderman Scott Black from Bloomington asked perhaps the biggest question of the night.
Can you walk me through how other communities have funded these types of projects, whether it be hotel motel tax, bonding, TIFs? What have you seen in your experience?
How to pay for it. And that's only if the Normal Town Council or Bloomington City Council or both decide to move ahead with the project. Both just went through difficult budget-cutting episodes up against flat or declining tax revenue streams. ELEF says similar communities are increasingly turning to public-private partnerships to build these complexes.
About 80% of our projects have some level of public-private partnership. On the public side, it's expensive to operate publicly. It's expensive to build in some cases, particularly in states like Illinois. On the private side, it's difficult to get a return on investment if you do it alone and you have those objectives of serving the community, because you just simply can't generate enough revenue to cover some of the current expenses for construction.
Private developers Dave Stark and Katie Kim last year proposed a public-private partnership for a sports complex on the community's west side. Illinois Fire Juniors announced in May it was embarking on a $2.3 million fundraising campaign, possibly to become a private partner in a public project or to acquire its own space to replace what's lost at community fields. ELEF says the project might qualify for new market tax credits, depending on which site is chosen. That program incentivizes private investment in distressed areas. Normal Mayor Chris Coos noted that interest from the private sector.
I'm not making any promises here, but there have been trial requests from the private sector to look at public-private partnerships on this. And I think, once we start, as council start making decisions about where we want to go with this, I think we may see more of that. We have been approached in an inquisitive manner, not saying we're in. They're interested and they want to look at it to be part of it.
Once it's open, ELEF says that complex operations could break even by year 5, or even sooner, by booking tournaments, selling food and beverage concessions, and renting fields. That doesn't include any public debt taken on by the project. Normal Town Council member Scott Preston also asked about potentially large capital replacement costs, such as replacing the dome or turf in those first 20 years. Here's ELEF's response.
It's an investment, not just a one-time investment, but it's a long-term investment into whatever the property and the ownership is. And the goal is to offset some of those expenses. We don't expect this facility to ever pay its own debt, either on the front end or the capital replacement, refinancing debt, whatever it may be.
Elected officials were still processing the information moments after the meeting ended. Here's Kathleen Lorenz from Normals Council.
That's a lot of money, no matter what. however, we've heard higher numbers and we've heard lower numbers. So the fact that it was kind of in a general ballpark made me feel okay about it. I thought the study and the numbers that he reviewed with us tonight seemed very credible.
Several leaders from Illinois Fire Juniors were also in the crowd, including Board President Tim Cook.
For us, it was just a validation of what we already knew as soccer families and parents who live the economic impact and take a lot of that economic impact out of Bloomington Normal and go play in tournaments in other cities. So this is something I think we knew, and it's just that validation of the impact it could have on our community.
I asked Cook, would it fit the needs of his youth soccer organization?
The fact that it's all turf and all lit it would be a big plus, because that expands the amount of hours and the time that you can use it. So that changes the dynamics a little bit when you go away from grass to synthetic. And so I believe that it's something in line with what would be successful and would fit the needs, at least, of our soccer organization as well.
Lorenz says that she was struck by the consultant's argument for the public health benefits of a complex, namely counteracting childhood obesity. She says the loss of community fields at the airport is concerning.
That does give me pause for, some of the things that we need to be mindful of in terms of quality of place and, what we do provide to our families.
The next steps would be the Bloomington and Normal Councils deciding whether they want to proceed with exploring the project further, including possible funding mechanisms. I'm Ryan Denham.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Joining us now to recap the study on the potential sports complex and what happened at last night's Normal Town Council meeting and what didn't happen is Mayor Chris Coos. Thanks for coming in today.
Good to be here.
The consultant said flat out, this is an investment in the community that will never break even. It will require constant renewal of the facility with some significant dollars if there is a dome. Do you think this is a high enough priority for the community to invest $44 million up front and a big chunk of that again every 20 years?
It's too early for me to say on that, Charlie. There's a lot we have to look at as a community. As two entities, City of Bloomington, Town of Normal, a lot of questions we have to answer in the sense that the one community or both communities saddle the whole burden, that will not happen. That's beyond the capacity of both communities to do that.
Well, you've been consistent about that over the last two sports complex, soccer field complex proposals. One, the Katie Kim proposal, and the one before that, and I'm blanking on the proposed developer's name on that one. Since there is growing competition as these facilities proliferate around the country, how reliable do you think that estimate of 8 to 15 tournaments a year is and the corresponding economic impact? So the reward part for the community part of the equation.
You know, I had a conversation with my Parks and Rec director afterwards, and he thought it was very doable with the right facility.
So he's positive.
He's convinced that the number of tournaments that they were referring to was not inflated by any means.
Okay. 43.6 million split two ways between Bloomington Normals, about 22 million apiece. The final tally would be lower with private partnership dollars included. How much private sector involvement should one expect in a project in Bloomington Normal, and what do you think is a reasonable share of such a project for each of the Twin Cities?
You know, again, we haven't done our due diligence on this, Charlie. It's hard for me to answer that question directly, but I think that the reference that you make, that we do have to look at that in terms of what's prudent for the community in terms of everything else we have to deal with. We have to be cognizant of that, and that's why I have said, and I will say again, that if it's a total public project, it's not going to happen. The capacity is not there, and it robs resources from other things that we need to do.
You are conversant with the Town of Normal's financial capacity. What is that? Obviously, there are lots of worthy projects out there that would add to the community. I've heard tell a library has been mentioned now and again. How much cap is there left for the town at this present time?
Not very much. You know, again, you put me in a position I can't answer a dollar amount directly, but I think the point is well taken that we have to look at what we can do, and that's why I've said consistently that there needs to be a public-private partnership. There needs to be efforts to secure grants, either health grants or sports grants from the state, from the federal government, if we can. It's going to take a basket of investments to make it move forward.
Projections for the community are for only modest growth and fairly flat to falling government revenue. Are either Bloomington or Normal in a position to make such an investment in a way that will be timely for Illinois Fire to find a new home, that is, within 3 years or so?
Well, if you recall last night, consulting group said that the report that they gave had about an 18-month shelf life.
And so the timeline is even shorter.
Yeah, the timeline is short, and the timeline is short for us to make a decision on what we're going to do with that. And I think you know in the Town of Normal that we'll proceed along that path in terms of the decision-making, and we'll pick a direction fairly quickly.
What kind of process do you think Bloomington and Normal should follow to discuss and decide these questions then?
Well, there's got to be dialogue between the two cities, and it's got to include any potential private side investment group or investors as part of the discussion.
Is the Katie Kim Stark proposal still alive?
As far as I can tell, it is, yeah.
So they're presumably one dialogue
Certainly.
Partner.
Certainly.
Are there others out there that you know
yes,
of?
Yes, there are.
Mm-hmm. Who?
You know I'm not going to tell you, Charlie.
How many?
One so far.
One so far.
And it is a group that's well known to the community, and it is a group with considerable resources.
So
and they are intrigued by it.
That's how I would characterize their involvement at this point.
So lay out the timeline if you have to actually decide in the next year and a half, in the next 6 months, what needs to happen, in the next year, what needs to happen.
Well, I think in the next 6 months, the parties that are interested in moving this forward should be able to state that. And the parties that are not interested in moving this forward should be able to state that as well.
How important is it, given the sometimes tense relationship between the city of Bloomington and the town of Normal, to receive guarantees or a memorandum of understanding or an intergovernmental agreement before or during the vote that any facility going ahead would need?
Well, I think, you know, I think both governmental units are interested in pursuing better cooperation, so maybe this will be a vehicle for it.
Should there be a referendum, or should representative government follow its role and have elected council members make these choices?
That's a tough one to answer right now. It just depends on what we go forward with. You know, we could put something out to the general public that upsets them deeply, and they may ask for a referendum on that.
Would the town council or town officials say, you know what, we need to take the temperature on this?
I'm not going to predict the future on that.
Okay. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us is Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal. After the presentation of the Sport Complex report, the town council went back to Uptown Station and held its own meeting. One item pulled from the agenda was a request by the developer of Uptown One to downsize the required restaurant to half the square footage as before. Do you know why that was pulled yet?
I do, but in deference to the developer, I can't really say what their reasoning for it was. I think it's more of a timing issue. I think they're still interested in doing that, but they're not interested in doing it just yet.
So it's likely to come back?
I think so.
Does the request mean the project is in trouble?
No. I think it means the scope has changed. Their expectation for a single-use ground floor is not fulfilling, so they're taking a different look at it.
How would they get the amount of revenue needed in the pro formas provided to the town under the development agreement if they have half a restaurant size?
Well, the square footage is the square footage. So whether it's two units or one unit, if they fill it as two units, they'll be fine.
What are they going to put in the other unit?
There's a couple of things that they've looked at, but I can't.
Speaking
I can't.
Generally, is it retail? Is it also food service?
I can't speak to it.
Okay. What do you want the town to have from the developer in exchange for potential approval of the request?
Well, we had asked, and part of the agreement is that we get a restaurant that will serve the uptown and fit into the mix of uptown, you know. And I'm pretty concerned about that in terms of what's developing at Trailside East, the office project across Uptown Circle from them, could have up to 250 office workers there, and that will put some pressure on the restaurant market in Uptown Normal.
So maybe they're underselling their capacity for square footage and a restaurant support of that square footage.
That could be. Mm-hmm.
A considerable period after opening, the building is not fully tenanted in apartments or in commercial space, and the town has taken up some of that space. Mm-hmm. It's been more than 2 years since the developer said it had hopes of announcing a restaurant tenant soon. Do those facts present any warning signs both for Uptown One and for Trail East?
Well, the absorption rate of the apartments is slower than they had predicted, but it's definitely moving in a positive direction. They've had three or four rentals in the last 2 weeks that I'm aware of, new ones. I think the ground floor is more concerning to them. And you know, we could spend an hour talking about restaurant markets in the United States and what works and what doesn't work and what the trends are. But these are some of the issues that they're dealing with.
Are they in danger, in the lack of a restaurant, of defaulting in the development agreement?
Oh, you know, Legally, yes. But we consider them a viable partner in Uptown, and we're going to work with them so that we get what we want and they get what they want.
How much are they losing out by not getting tax refunds from food and beverage taxes by not having that restaurant up and operating?
You know, it's not an insignificant amount of money, but it's not something that's a death knell for the project.
Is the town willing to restart the clock on that rebate period if they change the terms of the agreement?
Town's philosophy has always been we're going to work with our partners, and if something's not working, we'll sit down and talk about it. We're not going to be intractable on this.
The town also received a report last night about the end-of-year budget adjustments. $1.8 million in reserves were drawn down in the last year. The town went through a budget-cutting exercise, but pension costs and pressure of state government rake-offs of local revenue continues to loom. What is your outlook going forward on the financial picture?
Well, I think, as far as the picture that we have been able to paint in our five-year budget process was that these are issues that we're going to have to deal with. If you recall, Andrew Hune last night said we did have a deficit, but it's not as large as was projected. So there's some good news in the bad news with that. Our financial staff and department there is very, very good about conservatively looking at our outlook financially. And I'm confident in the information that they give us. I don't think we're going to be surprised.
You recently announced on Facebook that you were leaving Facebook and limiting social media. Why?
The environment has gotten so toxic, and that's in a broad sense. It's somewhat reflective of the mood of the country, where it's very divisive right now. But the more I have looked at it, to me, it's like reading the National Enquirer. The information is not very reliable. It is very, very skewed to an opinion. And I just got tired of that.
So what are you doing? How far are you cutting the cord?
Pardon?
Is it a permanent decision?
Oh, it was when I did it, but I've calmed down a little bit, and I'm just going to take a break.
Can a public official in this day and age not engage? Isn't that part of your public duty?
It is, but not necessarily with that vehicle.
Well, we'll substitute for it. A lot of the discourse does happen on social media platforms.
I will probably try to get more active on Twitter, which I don't use right now. But you're right. I do need to talk to the public. I'm willing to face-to-face converse with just about anybody. So it's not that I'm going to be quiet. But I don't need the bully pulpit of Facebook.
Your initial comment that presumably led to pushback was that you cannot stay silent any longer about the president's conduct. What led you to that post, and what are you thinking about the nature of public discourse?
I think the behaviors, the integrity, and lack of veracity of our current president troubles me quite a bit. Most recent activities in Helsinki have pushed me more in that direction. I'm very fearful where that president will take this country or try to take this country, and I will speak out about that.
You are a Republican. Is he?
No, he is not, by the definition of Republicanism that I know.
After the events in Helsinki, though, does silence on any platform signify consent?
No, it doesn't.
If you're not there, though, you're not countering it.
So the question is, do I need to be everywhere?
Well, that is the question.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I don't think so.
Okay. The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after regular and special council meetings. Mayor Chris Coos of the town of Normal, thank you so much for your time today.
Always enjoy the conversation.
Support for GLT comes from the Central Illinois Regional Airport, encouraging travelers to support the local economy and enjoy a convenient airport experience, including free parking. CIRA says, don't travel before you travel. Fly local. Details and schedules at CIRA.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a look at globalization in the digital sense. With the rise of the Me Too movement came awareness of non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment and assault cases. Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault Executive Director Polly Poskin speaks with Mary Cullen on who reaps the benefits.
Non-disclosure agreements or confidentiality agreements can be used in any situation where two parties want to keep the details and arrangements secret. Most recently, awareness has been brought to the use of non-disclosure agreements in cases of workplace sexual harassment and assault. Poskin says non-disclosure agreements are used to protect the accused and that it's time to talk about a law restricting their use.
At some point when businesses or unions or even an individual, if he or she is a repetitive harasser, it has the effect of a cover-up. And, you know, we just have to have laws governing non-disclosure agreements because something needs to limit, if not eradicate, these confidentiality agreements because they really serve to protect the defendant. They really serve to protect the perpetrator and or the entity that's responsible for the employment or the representation of an individual that does this.
Can you explain what exactly a non-disclosure agreement is and what do they typically entail?
A non-disclosure agreement really is, it's a confidential settlement, and I think it kind of sets parameters about the incident, the subject matter, but it doesn't disclose any of the, perhaps the secrets of the settlement. You know, they become more known to us, I think, as a result of the Me Too movement, and essentially they are it's a deal cutting with defendants, and it prevents the victim or the plaintiff from publishing or revealing any of the results of the agreement.
So the state of Washington actually passed a law earlier this year, I believe in April, banning the use of non-disclosure agreements for claims of sexual harassment or assault. So why do companies use non-disclosure agreements, and what is the benefit to the employer?
Well, the benefit to the employer, it silences the plaintiff. It silences the victim. You know, that means that it hides or it conceals the claims of harassment. So then that, you know, sort of enables the business or the individual or the union from being revealed for the behavior that was perpetrated.
With that ability to conceal that type of behavior, is there a concern that maybe a company is just using this non-disclosure agreement to conceal one instance of sexual harassment or assault? But then there's the other side where it could be an ongoing issue that is never really brought to light because of non-disclosure agreements. Is that correct?
Well, yes, it is. Because I think, you know, these confidentiality provisions, I mean, I think they, you know, they hide sort of the severity and the pervasiveness of the harassment. So it's very damaging to the victim. I think, and it's also another silencer. I mean, victims of sexual violence, whether it be harassment or sexual assault, you know, they live in this culture in sort of an enforced silence. We tend to think the victims are the guilty ones. We tend to think that there was something the victim could have done to prevent that. We think that's something the victim did to engage, you know, that perpetrating behavior. You know, sometimes victims have always felt that it's in their best interest for there to be silence, either their own self-imposed silence or, in this case, maybe a legal silence, if you will, about what has happened to them, because they'll be, in effect, you know, further victimized if this becomes known. And then the companies or the business or the union, the individuals, they sort of build on that, you know, societal victim blaming to reach an agreement, reach a settlement about, well, we'll never talk about it, when in fact they're really taking care of themselves. They're really protecting sort of their own image or their own liability, or in some instances they just might be plain protecting the employee or the union member or the individual that they value greater than the person who's been victimized. That's created this culture of victim blaming, and it's created a culture of silence about what has happened. I mean, that's why, you know, all the way from Bill Cosby to Harvey Weinstein to Nassar at Michigan State University, to get away with what they did for so long and for it to have such severe impact on a victim's life and on our culture, so that we have sort of developed a sense of either immunity to the severity and the impact that it has on the victim, or we have developed a culture that minimizes how seriously sexual victimization, sexual violence impacts the victim and the lives of people close to her.
Building off of that, you mentioned many times that a non-disclosure agreement is often used protecting the person who actually committed this harassment, or even the employer. How does it impact the victim?
Well, I think it oftentimes leaves victim with this sense of helplessness about what else could I do. And there is nothing worse, actually, to live in the human, you know, race on this beautiful planet to experience, you know, helplessness. And I think a victim confronted with this notion of, do I go public? You know, do I really take up the banner? Will there be folks behind me? Will I be supported? So they feel very helpless in knowing ahead of time if they're going to get any support. Am I going to get the kind of response? And even the protection, the subsequent protection around this behavior. Will my job be insured? Will the union, you know, not stand up for me as vigorously, perhaps, if it's known that I'm going to speak out about the behavior that's been perpetrated against me? And so, there's just this layer of helplessness that certainly comes into the play of what kind of decisions the victim has to make regarding this non-disclosure agreement proposal to them. And then it frustrates us, as anybody who would be confronted with that. And it makes us angry, you know, that I sort of have to trade off my fear about how I'll be further victimized for silence. So it's just a bad cycle in an individual's life, and it's a bad cycle, quite honestly, in the culture of that business environment or the culture of that union, or the individual who's sort of forcing that non-disclosure agreement. And it's hideous to our society. We really want a society that has more openness, more transparency, more sensitivity to the impact that violating behavior has on human beings. And so it's very detrimental to the victim, to the plaintiff.
Growing from that point right there, how it's detrimental to the victim, it's often said that in order for a non-disclosure agreement to be issued, it should be at the request of the victim. So can you comment on how that would impact and might change things?
Well, that way you'd be honoring the victim in the process. That would be recognizing that the victim wants to sort of control the outcome of this heinous behavior that has happened, and the fact that it's so adversely impacted them personally, perhaps economically, financially, maybe in their relationships, and certainly in their work environment or in their union environment, if they're a strong, you know, union activist or participant in their union, has this sort of adverse impact. To think about having to make that decision. At the same time, if they say, I'm going to need this, because if this were known to my children, I'm just going to have to deal with emotional issues, and family issues, and relationship issues that right now are too challenging in my life. If this is known in the company of which I'm succeeding in and perhaps advancing in, this could be seriously detrimental. Their choices might be limited as to where they could transfer, where they could get a new job, or, you know, the length of their career, all of which is important because, you know, we want to succeed as we're in a career and we want to be, you know, comfortable, you know, in our retirement when we leave a career. So there could be all kinds of reasons that a victim might wish for there to be a non-disclosure agreement, because it could present more challenges and more barriers than they are at that moment in time capable of overcoming and being successful in the areas of their life, the priorities of their life that they feel they're succeeding in. So that's important to the victim. I mean, just as a system, as a society, we should recognize that victims should choose the outcome that sort of is most suitable to them for their recovery, and sort of how they feel that they can more freely kind of move about in the world past the incident of the victimization.
So in your position, you're obviously involved in tons of conversations having to do with sexual assault victims across the state. Would you say there might be a chance of Illinois having a law similar to the one that was passed in Washington that would ban the use?
Well, it wouldn't be a step too far. And there has been a lot of discussion about it. There has, you know, sort of the step of not using public funds to create a settlement. Lots of discussion around that. I think it's a step in the effort of transparency and a step in believing and supporting the victim and honoring the victim's wishes in the outcome of this very heinous journey that she has to embark on before there's some semblance of recovery and moving forward. So it's a proposal whose time has come, and it's a conversation that needs to happen, and it will put victims at the front of public policy that acknowledges and recognizes the sexual victimization, the impact that it has on her, him as the victim, and what should be the conclusion, what should be the resolution of, you know, the incident, and tipped more in favor of the victim.
That was Mary Cullen speaking with Polly Poskin, Executive Director of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault, on the use of non-disclosure agreements.
Support for GLT comes from the Rhonda Glenn Law Offices. With offices in McLean and Livingston counties, they've served clients throughout Illinois for 30 years with quality legal services and family law, including adoption and dissolution of marriage. Information at glennlawoffices.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It used to be that American cultural influence spread across the world with the help of movie theaters, compact discs, and records. Now it's downloads and websites. Illinois State University political scientist Lane Crothers specializes in the study of globalization. A new edition of his book, Globalization and American Popular Culture, looks at the growth and global scope of social media.
We, of course, often think predominantly in terms of groups like Facebook, and with good reason. Facebook has, what, 1.8 billion independent monthly users at this point in time. If it was a country, it would be the largest country in the world. But we're not the only one. The Chinese have built their own social media system. There are other competing social media systems out there. And of course, there's other kind of more specialized or niche systems available. And what this has done is interlink people around the world into communities in which their actual geographic location no longer matters. All that matters is, are they a member of this same digital group or digital orbit of groups where these kinds of ideas are shared and these kind of experiences are shared?
So that would, I guess, tend to promote the idea of all physicists get together and all poets get together and all filmmakers get together. But how does it impact the popular culture?
Well, you have to, and there's a couple of different answers to that question, so forgive me if this goes on for a while. The first one is, if you just think about it in terms of raw programming terms, there's an enormous numbers of channels, of digital resources, of devices and products seeking your attention, right? We've built what's being called the attention economy, right, where the real thing that everybody's fighting for is your eyeballs. They're fighting for your eyeballs for advertising purposes, for perhaps propaganda purposes, as we think regarding the Russians, right? And so they're fighting for that, and they need to fill that time, and they need to fill that space, and it's, in fact, completely unfillable, right? Because it's endless. It's not like the old days when you and I were kids and television went off the air at midnight and you could watch the color bars and the Star Spangled Banner and that was it, right? It's endless. One of the great advantages, if you are someone in the business of appealing for attention, one of the great advantages of American popular culture, whether you've licensed it legally, whether you've created it, or you are pirating it, is that there's a vast amount of it already readily available for you to use and to put out there on whatever platform you're seeking to put it out. Moreover, that product, that whether it's movies, music, television, fast food, clothing, whatever it is, has already been globally tested and found to be globally appealing. Right. We already know that it's popular in a lot of places around the world, and we already know that it's popular in places that we're politically not connected to very closely, right? American popular culture, American television programs and movies are every bit as popular in Iran as they are in the United States, right? It's not a – it doesn't matter that the governments don't get along.
Isn't there still a tendency, though, to pay attention to the economics? If the Chinese are doubling down in Africa, won't some African nations be more disposed to pick up Chinese cultural products than U.S. cultural products?
Well, that's one of the great questions that's out there. And since this process is unfolding, we don't know. It's a little bit easier. I can't speak enough about the kind of Chinese products that are available and what their structure and nature are. But let's put it in terms of something like Bollywood. Bollywood, the Indian movie industry, makes far more movies than the United States does every year, or they get made by whatever we might call Hollywood, however broadly you want to define that term.
And you can see some of them at Marcus Theaters in Bloomington Normal.
Exactly right. And they're fun, and they are what they are. But they're also, so far at least, still pretty significantly niche programs embedded in a particular cultural point of view. That culture is spreading. That culture is embedding its people all over the world, as we're finding in Bloomington Normal or whatever else. So it may. But so far, at least, it hasn't become the kind of globally pervasive, globally popular product that American popular culture has proved itself to be. So you have that just broad question about an appealing channel. Are there competitors? Are there areas where it's not competitive? All of that is true. But on average, it's more competitive, it's more globally appealing, and it's been that way for about a century now. In fact, I was in Istanbul about a year ago, a little over a year ago, giving a talk, and I started my talk with the question, how come I don't know anything about Turkish popular culture, but you know a lot about American popular culture? And what was very interesting was their response. The audience laughed. Because it apparently seemed absurd to them that I would know anything about Turkish popular culture. And it's perfectly obvious why they know everything about American popular culture, right? Because of its global presence and its global pervasiveness. And yet Turkish and the Turkic languages are one of the most commonly spoken group of languages in the world. All those places that Americans don't ever talk about, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and, you know, all those people, they're all Turkic language speaking people. Nonetheless, you have that kind of global appeal. So that, I would argue, is one thing that seems to provide a tool or a mechanism to be globally pervasive.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with ISU Professor of Politics and Government, Lane Crothers, about globalization and American popular culture. It may be that, as you say, you know, the last 100 years have been pretty good for American cultural products, but it does not necessarily follow that past success is the prologue. It gives a competitive advantage because it's known, but economic hegemony is eroding, so why wouldn't cultural hegemony erode?
I wouldn't deny the possibility. I mean, unfortunately, not that good at telling the future, and if I was, my stock portfolio would be better than it is. What I can say is that there has to be a product or a group of products or a package of products that is also as appealing. And at present, that's not true for most people and most cultural products. And particularly because American popular culture is either deliberately or accidentally, it doesn't matter which, associated with the broad patterns of what people think about the United States to begin with, right? Which is that it's relatively free and that it's relatively rich and that you have the opportunity to build a certain kind of life in this country in a way that is clearly not the case in China. And so while China might build you a great road and China might build you a great harbor, I don't think very many people globally right now are aspiring to the sociocultural structure of China. Now, that may change. The world is a big and complicated place, and Lord knows we're going through our populist moment right now where authoritarianism is rising, but there you are.
Well, that's the next question, is how is that populist rage and that populist rightist moment on the global stage affecting the perception of American cultural products?
That is such a wonderful question, and I can find no evidence that it's changed anything. But let me say that advisedly. What I mean by that is there's always been a tension, right? That is, while the products are broadly appealing, they're also always problematic in the eyes of a number of figures. And so you can take an easy one, right? The French have always been ambiguous about American popular culture or uncertain because, of course, it's packaged in English. And they have worked over time to try to protect French as a language and put a number of cultural barriers up to try to reduce the impact of American popular culture.
Franglais, yeah.
That's right. The mixing of French and English language. And At one point in time, one of the more interesting examples was they sued Georgia Tech because Georgia Tech put an ad up on the internet for an online program, and that ad appeared in France. It wasn't on a server in France. It wasn't aimed at France, but it appeared in France, and Georgia Tech got sued. France sued Georgia Tech because the ad wasn't in French. And more broadly, if you look at the broad question over time, whether it was in the old days when we had a general agreement on tariffs and trade, GATT, and today under the World Trade Organization's, culture is one of the major areas in cultural products where countries are still allowed to put trade barriers up and protect their domestic culture-producing institutions, mostly there to protect them from being either outcompeted or simply purchased by wealthy American providers. And the United States' position has been throughout almost all that period that that's wrong and we should just have open and free competition in these ideas. Moro, it's not just about, you know, fear that American products and American companies will come in and overwhelm. It's also the case that popular culture is particularly interesting and particularly intriguing to younger people. Which also, and to the degree that cultural products bear the imprint of the culture that produces them or that created them in their initial stages, then if you're an established elderly person in Iran, say, and all of a sudden your 14-year-old daughter is singing hip-hop songs to herself, you are very likely to perceive that as a significant problem. And the, I think, useful to remember, in the United States, we're really used to all these new cultural products and new ideas, and we're used to trends, and we're used to people being different in terms of how they dress and how they behave. And we still get upset about some of these cultural changes and some of these cultural products.
Especially when we start to age out of currency.
Absolutely correct. That said, you can only then imagine what somebody who's not as used to it, who's not as embedded in it, looks at, and they look at what they think is the dying of their culture as the youth get corrupted by some other agency.
Well, since the digital era is well and truly underway then, and the borders and feet on the ground don't matter as much as they used to, how is the resistance to American cultural products from the older generations or the more traditionalist portion of those populaces, how is that taking shape? Is it becoming more desperate? Is it becoming more angsty or more militant? What's happening?
Well, I think, you know, and a couple of useful examples here. You can look at a case like Iran, which has made satellite dishes illegal and made a number of other different kind of mechanisms by which often American popular cultural products make it into their country they've sought to control. From all accounts, every house in Iran has a satellite dish on it. So there's a gap between the rhetoric and the actual practice. And it's kind of that classic hypocritical nudge wink. We'll let them have their say, and then we'll go live the lives we want to lead. And
I'll get Uncle Benny to install it. Yeah.
Something, you know, just to get it done, right? So there's that approach. The other approach is more like the Chinese approach. And the Chinese invest enormous amounts of money and enormous amounts of effort and enormous numbers of people monitoring the internet. They spend an enormous amount of time blocking certain kind of searches and blocking certain kind of phrases and making sure that only certain channels of information are available to them, either by, it's called the Great Wall of China. It's considered this blocking mechanism, either in the sense that they have real-time monitors, or they make a contract with somebody like Google or Apple or Microsoft with Bing, and they say, if you want to operate in this country, you need to automatically block certain kind of searches and therefore try to exclude entire classes of information from their people.
As success, not success?
You know, it depends. As technological things go, for a long time, apparently, the Chinese system wasn't that hard to beat if you went to a VPN client. You installed a VPN client, you presented yourself as from Switzerland or wherever else, and you got everything you wanted. I gather that in recent years, the Chinese have gotten better at shutting that down. Being an American, I tend to believe that in the end, people's creativity on the rules are far more powerful than the enforcer of rules, right? That if you give people enough time and enough creativity, they'll figure out a way to break almost any rule and get what they want.
7 years ago, you wrote an article for the Huffington Post talking about how you thought that American cultural products were going to do very nicely in the digital age. And that has continued to happen. You are correct, sir.
Once in a while.
What hadn't you anticipated in the last 7 years that came as a surprise when you were doing this book?
I think really biggest thing that I've gotten is the degree to which the gap between, one is the gap between what governments want and what the culture does. Right. It's kind of like the speed limit. Right. And which almost everybody treats the speed limit as a speed minimum. And you get mad at people who actually go at or near the speed limit. So there's always this ginormous gap between what the people are into and what the people are going to do. And then the question is, how aggressively does the government seek to try to repress or control it? So that's one, and really trying to tease that out. The other one has been, and I'm not sure I was surprised by this, but at least I've been forced to confront it. I am convinced that most Americans believe that most of the world wants to be American. Right, that they want to have American values and an American lifestyle. And I think most of the rest of the world just likes the stuff we produce. But they wish to continue to be whoever they are. And teasing that out and really often trying to help Americans see that their worldview is more insulated than they think it is. Often is important. I remember being at the Coliseum in Rome one time, and the person taking tickets was speaking to people in like seven different languages. And I was like, if you have to speak seven different languages to be a ticket taker, that's a very different kind of society than we have in the United States, where we complain if somebody speaks Spanish.
Lane Crothers is a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University. His book is Globalization and American Popular Culture. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Thanks as well to Ryan Denham and Mary Cullen today. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.